good for the sad realm of Narnia. Tava, the Lord of Victory, salutes Alambil, the Lady of Peace. They are just coming to their nearest.
It's a pity that tree gets in the way, said Caspian. We'd really see better from the West Tower, though it is not so high.
Dr. Cornelius said nothing for about 2 minutes, but stood still, with his eyes fixed on Tava and Alambil. Then he drew a deep breath and turned to Caspian.
There, he said. You have seen what no man now alive has seen nor will see again. And you are right. We should have seen it even better from the smaller tower. I brought you here for another reason.
Caspian looked up at him, but the doctor's hood concealed most of his face.
The virtue of this tower, said Dr. Cornelius, is that we have 6 empty rooms beneath us, and a long stair, and the door at the bottom of the stair is locked. We cannot be overheard.
Are you going to tell me what you wouldn't tell me the other day? Said Caspian.
I am, said the doctor, but remember, you and I must never talk about these things except here, on the very top of the great tower.
No, that's a promise, said Caspian, but do go on, please.
Listen, said the doctor. All you have heard about old Narnia is true. It is not the land of men, it is the country of Aslan, the country of the waking trees and visible naiads, of fauns and satyrs, of dwarfs and giants, of the gods and the centaurs, of talking beasts. It was against that the first Caspian fought. It is you Telmarines who silenced the beasts and the trees and the fountains, and who killed and drove away the dwarfs and fauns, and are now trying to cover up even the memory of them. The king does not allow them to be spoken of.
Oh, I do wish we hadn't, said Caspian, and I am glad it was all true, even if it is all over.
Many of your race wish that in secret, said Dr. Cornelius.
But, Doctor, said Caspian, why do you say my race? After all, I suppose you're a Telmarine too.
Am I? Said the Doctor.
Well, you're a man, anyway, said Caspian.
Am I? Repeated the doctor in a deeper voice, at the same moment throwing back his hood so that Caspian could see his face clearly in the moonlight.
All at once, Caspian realized the truth and felt that he ought to have realized it long before. Dr. Cornelius was so small and so fat and had such a very long beard. 2 thoughts came into his head at the same moment. One was a thought of terror.
He's not a real man, not a man at all. He's a dwarf, and he's brought me up here to kill me.
The other was sheer delight.
There are real dwarfs still, and I've seen one at last.
So you've guessed it in the end, said Dr. Cornelius, or guessed it nearly right. I'm not pure dwarf. I have human blood in me too. Many dwarfs escaped in the great battles and lived on, shaving their beards and wearing high-heeled shoes and pretending to be men. They have mixed with your Telmarines. I am one of those, only a half-dwarf, and if any of my kindred, the true dwarfs, are still alive anywhere in the world, doubtless they would despise me and call me a traitor. But never in all these years have we forgotten our own people and all the other happy creatures of Narnia, and the long-lost days of freedom.
I'm sorry, Doctor, said Caspian. It wasn't my fault, you know.
I am not saying these things in blame of you, dear Prince, answered the Doctor. You may well ask why I say them at all, but I have 2 reasons. Firstly, because my old heart has carried these secret memories so long that it aches with them, and would burst if I did not whisper them to you. But secondly for this, that when you become king, you may help us, for I know that you also, Telmarine though you are, love the old things.
I do, said Caspian. But how can I help?
You can be kind to the poor remnants of the dwarf people like myself. You can gather learned magicians and try to find a way of awakening the trees once more. You can search through all the nooks and wild places of the land to see if any fauns or talking beasts or dwarfs are perhaps still alive in hiding.
Do you think there are any? Asked Caspian eagerly.
I don't know. I don't know, said the doctor with a deep sigh. Sometimes I'm afraid there can't be. I've been looking for traces of them all my life. Sometimes I've thought I heard a dwarf drum in the mountains. Sometimes at night, in the woods, I thought I'd caught a glimpse of fauns and satyrs dancing a long way off. But when I came to the place, there was never anything there. I've often despaired, but something always happens to start me hoping again. I don't know. But at least you can try to be a king like the High King Peter of old, and not like your uncle.
Then it's true about the kings and queens, too, and about the White Witch? Said Caspian.
Certainly it is true, said Cornelius. Their reign was the golden age in Narnia, and the land has never forgotten them.
Did they live in this castle, Doctor?
Nay, my dear, said the old man. This castle is a thing of yesterday. Your great-great-grandfather built it. But when the two sons of Adam and the two daughters of Eve were made kings and queens of Narnia by Aslan himself, they lived in the castle of Caer Paravel. No man alive has seen that blessed place, and perhaps even the ruins of it have now vanished. But we believe it was far from here, down at the mouth of the great river, on the very shore of the sea.
Ugh, said Caspian with a shudder. Do you mean in the Black Woods, where all the ghosts live?
Your Highness speaks as you have been taught, said the doctor, but it is all lies. There are no ghosts there. That is a story invented by the Telmarines. Your kings are in deadly fear of the sea because they can never quite forget that in all stories Aslan comes from over the sea. They don't want to go near it, and they don't want anyone else to go near it. So they have let great woods grow up to cut their people off from the coast. But because they have quarrelled with the trees, they are afraid of the woods. And because they are afraid of the woods, they imagine that they are full of ghosts. And the kings and great men, hating both the sea and the wood, partly believe these stories, and partly encourage them. They feel safer if no one in Narnia dares go down to the coast and look out to sea towards Aslan's land, and the morning and the eastern end of the world.
There was a deep silence between them for a few minutes. Then Dr. Cornelius said,
Come, we have been here long enough. It is time to go down and to bed.
Must we? Said Caspian. I'd like to go on talking about these things for hours and hours and hours.
Someone might begin looking for us if we did that, said Dr. Cornelius.
Chapter 5. Caspian's Adventure in the Mountains. After this, Caspian and his tutor had many more secret conversations on the top of the great tower, and at each conversation Caspian learned more about old Narnia, so that thinking and dreaming about the old days and longing that they might come back filled nearly all his spare hours. But of course he had not many hours to spare, for now his education was beginning in earnest. He learned sword fighting and riding, swimming and diving, how to shoot with the bow and play on the recorder and the theorbo, how to hunt the stag and cut him up when he was dead, besides cosmography, rhetoric, heraldry, versification, and of course history, with a little lore, physics, alchemy and astronomy. Of magic he learned only the theory, for Dr. Cornelius said the practical part was not proper study for princes. And I myself, he added, am only a very imperfect magician and can do only the smallest experiments. Of navigation, which is a noble and heroical art, said the doctor, he was taught nothing because King Miraz disapproved of ships and the sea. He also learned a great deal by using his own eyes and ears. As a little boy, he had often wondered why he disliked his aunt, Queen Prunaprismia. He now saw that it was because she disliked him. He also began to see that Narnia was an unhappy country. The taxes were high, and the laws were stern, and Miraz was a cruel man. After some years there came a time when the Queen seemed to be ill, and there was a great deal of bustle and pother about her in the castle, and doctors came and the courtiers whispered. This was in early summer time. And one night, while all this fuss was going on, Caspian was unexpectedly wakened by Dr. Cornelius after he had been only a few hours in bed.
"Are we going to do a little astronomy, Doctor?" said Caspian.
"Hush!" said the Doctor. "Trust me and do exactly as I tell you. Put on all your clothes. You have a long journey before you."
Caspian was very surprised, but he had learned to have confidence in his tutor, and he began doing what he was told at once. When he was dressed, the doctor said,
"I have a wallet for you. We must go into the next room and fill it with victuals from your Highness's supper table."
"My gentlemen in waiting will be there," said Caspian.
"They are fast asleep and will not wake," said the doctor. "I am a very minor magician, but I can at least contrive a charmed sleep."
They went into the antechamber, and there, sure enough, the two gentlemen in waiting were, sprawling on chairs and snoring hard. Dr. Cornelius quickly cut up the remains of a cold chicken and some slices of venison, and put them, with bread and an apple or so, and a little flask of good wine, into the wallet, which he then gave to Caspian. It fitted on by a strap over Caspian's shoulder, like a satchel you would use for taking books to school.
"Have you your sword?" asked the doctor.
"Yes,"
said Caspian.
"Then put this mantle over all to hide the sword and the wallet. That's right. And now we must go to the great tower and talk."
When they had reached the top of the tower, it was a cloudy night, not at all like the night when they had seen the conjunction of Tava and Allenbill, Dr. Cornelius said,
"Dear Prince, you must leave this castle at once and go to seek your fortune in the wide world. Your life is in danger here."
"Why?" asked Caspian.
"Because you are the true king of Narnia, Caspian the 10th, the true son and heir of Caspian the 9th. Long life to your majesty."
And suddenly, to Caspian's great surprise, the little man dropped down on one knee and kissed his hand.
"What does it all mean? I don't understand," said Caspian.
"I wonder you have never asked me before," said the doctor, "why, being the son of King Caspian, you are not King Caspian yourself. Everyone except your majesty knows that Miraz is a usurper. When he first began to rule, he did not even pretend to be the king. He called himself Lord Protector. But then your royal mother died, the good queen and the only Telmarine who was ever kind to me. And then one by one, all the great lords who had known your father died or disappeared. Not by accident, either. Miraz weeded them out. Belisar and Uvalas were shot with arrows on a hunting party. By chance, it was pretended. All the great house of the Passerids he sent to fight giants on the northern frontier till one by one they fell. Arlian and Eremon and a dozen more he executed for treason on a false charge. The two brothers of Beaver's Dam he shut up as madmen. And finally he persuaded the seven noble lords, who alone among all the Telmarines did not fear the sea, to sail away and look for new lands beyond the eastern ocean, and, as he intended, they never came back. And when there was no one left who could speak a word for you, then his flatterers, as he had instructed them, begged him to become king. And of course he did."
"Do you mean he now wants to kill me too?" said Caspian.
"That is almost certain," said Dr. Cornelius.
"But why now?" said Caspian. "I mean, why didn't he do it long ago if he wanted to? And what harm have I done him?"
"He has changed his mind about you because of something that happened only 2 hours ago. The Queen has had a son."
"I don't see what that's got to do with it," said Caspian.
"Don't see?" exclaimed the doctor. "Have all my lessons in history and politics taught you no more than that? Listen. As long as he had no children of his own, he was willing enough that you should be king after he died. He may not have cared much about you, but he would rather you should have the throne than a stranger. Now that he has a son of his own, he will want his own son to be the next king. You are in the way. He'll clear you out of the way."
"Is he really as bad as that?" said Caspian. "Would he really murder me?"
"He murdered your father," said Dr. Cornelius.
Caspian felt very strange and said nothing.
"I can tell you the whole story," said the doctor, "but not now. There is no time. You must fly at once."
"You'll come with me?" said Caspian.
"I dare not," said the doctor. "It would make your danger greater. Two are more easily tracked than one. Dear prince, dear King Caspian, you must be very brave. You must go alone and at once. Try to get across the southern border to the court of King Nain of Arkenland. He will be good to you."
"Shall I never see you again?" said Caspian in a quavering voice.
"I hope so, dear king," said the doctor. "What friend have I in the world except your majesty? And I have a little magic. But in the meantime, speed is everything. Here are two gifts before you go. This is a little purse of gold. Alas, all the treasure in this castle should be your own by rights. And here is something far better."
He put in Caspian's hands something which he could hardly see, but which he knew by the feel to be a horn.
"That," said Dr. Cornelius, "is the greatest and most sacred treasure of Narnia. Many terrors I endured, many spells did I utter to find it when I was still young. It is the magic horn of Queen Susan herself, which she left behind her when she vanished from Narnia at the end of the Golden Age. It is said that whoever blows it shall have strange help. No one can say how strange. It may have the power to call Queen Lucy and King Edmund and Queen Susan and High King Peter back from the past, and they will set all to rights. It may be that it will call up Aslan himself. Take it, King Caspian, but do not use it except at your greatest need. And now, haste, haste, haste. The little door at the very bottom of the tower, the door into the garden, is unlocked. There we must part."
"Can't I get my horse, Destria?" said Caspian.
"He is already saddled and waiting for you just at the corner of the orchard."
During the long climb down the winding staircase, Cornelius whispered many more words of direction and advice. Caspian's heart was sinking, but he tried to take it all in. Then came the fresh air in the garden, a fervent hand clasp from the doctor, a run across the lawn, a welcoming whinny from Destria. And so King Caspian X left the castle of his fathers. Looking back, he saw fireworks going up to celebrate the birth of the new prince. All night he rode southward, choosing byways and bridle paths through woods as long as he was in country that he knew, but afterwards he kept to the high road. Destria was as excited as his master at this unusual journey, and Caspian, though tears had come into his eyes at saying goodbye to Dr. Cornelius, felt brave and, in a way, happy to think that here was King Caspian riding to seek adventures with his sword on his left hip and Queen Susan's magic horn on his right. But when day came with a sprinkle of rain and he looked about him and saw on every side unknown woods, wild heaths and blue mountains, he thought how large and strange the world was and felt frightened and small. As soon as it was full daylight, he left the road and found an open grassy place amid a wood where he could rest. He took off Destria's bridle and let him graze, ate some cold chicken and drank a little wine, and presently fell asleep. It was late afternoon when he awoke. He ate a morsel and continued his journey, still southward, by many unfrequented lanes. He was now in a land of hills, going up and down, but always more up than down. From every ridge he could see the mountains growing bigger and blacker ahead. As the evening closed in, he was riding their lower slopes. The wind rose. Soon rain fell in torrents. Destria became uneasy. There was thunder in the air. And now they entered a dark and seemingly endless pine forest, and all the stories Caspian had ever heard of trees being unfriendly to man crowded into his mind. He remembered that he was, after all, a Telmarine, one of the race who cut down trees wherever they could and were at war with all wild things, and though he himself might be unlike other Telmarines, the trees could not be expected to know this. Nor did they. The wind became a tempest. The woods roared and creaked all round them. There came a crash. A tree fell right across the road just behind him. "Quiet, Destria, quiet," said Caspian, patting his horse's neck. But he was trembling himself, and he knew that he had escaped death by an inch. Lightning flashed, and a great crack of thunder seemed to break the sky in two just overhead. Destria bolted in good earnest. Caspian was a good rider, but he had not the strength to hold him back. He kept his seat, but he knew that his life hung by a thread during the wild career that followed. Tree after tree rose up before them in the dusk and was only just avoided. Then, almost too suddenly to hurt, and yet it did hurt him too, something struck Caspian on the forehead, and he knew no more. When he came to himself, he was lying in a firelit place with bruised limbs and a bad headache. Low voices were speaking close at hand.
"And now," said one, "before it wakes up, we must decide what to do with it."
"Kill it," said another. "We can't let it live. It would betray us."
"We ought to have killed it at once, or else let it alone," said a third voice. "We can't kill it now. Not after we've taken it in and bandaged its head and all. It would be murdering a guest."
"Gentlemen," said Caspian in a feeble voice, "whatever you do to me, I hope you will be kind to my poor horse."
"Your horse has taken flight long before we found you," said the first voice, a curiously husky, earthy voice, as Caspian now noticed.
"Now don't let it talk you round with its pretty words," said the second voice. "I still say..."
"Horns and alibuts," exclaimed the third voice. "Of course we're not going to murder it. For shame, Knickerbrick. What do you say, Truffle Hunter? What shall we do with it?"
"I shall give it a drink," said the first voice, presumably Truffle Hunter's.
A dark shape approached the bed. Caspian felt an arm slipped gently under his shoulders. If it was exactly an arm, the shape somehow seemed wrong. The face that bent towards him seemed wrong, too. He got the impression that it was very hairy and very long-nosed, and there were odd white patches on each side of it. "It's a mask of some sort," thought Caspian, "or perhaps I'm in a fever and imagining it all." A cupful of something sweet and hot was set to his lips, and he drank. At that moment, one of the others poked the fire. A blaze sprang up, and Caspian almost screamed with the shock as the sudden light revealed the face that was looking into his own. It was not a man's face, but a badger's, though larger and friendlier and more intelligent than the face of any badger he had seen before. And it had certainly been talking. He saw, too, that he was on a bed of heather in a cave. By the fire sat two little bearded men, so much wilder and shorter and hairier and thicker than Dr. Cornelius, that he knew them at once for real dwarfs, ancient dwarfs with not a drop of human blood in their veins. And Caspian knew that he had found the old Narnians at last. Then his head began to swim again. In the next few days he learned to know them by names. The badger was called Truffle Hunter. He was the oldest and kindest of the three. The dwarf who had wanted to kill Caspian was a sour black dwarf. That is, his hair and beard were black and thick and hard like horsehair. His name was Knickerbrick. The other dwarf was a red dwarf with hair rather like a fox's, and he was called Trumpkin.
"And now,"
said Knickerbrick on the first evening when Caspian was well enough to sit up and talk,
"we still have to decide what to do with this human.
You two think you've done it a great kindness by not letting me kill it, but I suppose the upshot is that we have to keep it a prisoner for life. I'm certainly not going to let it go alive, to go back to its own kind and betray us all.
"Bulbs and bolsters, Knickerbrick," said Trumpkin. "Why need you talk so unhandsomely? It isn't the creature's fault that it bashed its head against a tree outside our hole. And I don't think it looks like a traitor."
"I say," said Caspian, "you haven't yet found out whether I want to go back." "I don't. I want to stay with you, if you'll let me. I've been looking for people like you all my life."
"That's a likely story," growled Knickerbrick. "You're a Telmarine and a human, aren't you? Of course you want to go back to your own kind."
"Well, even if I did, I couldn't," said Caspian. "I was flying for my life when I had an accident. The king wants to kill me. If you'd killed me, you'd have done the very thing to please him."
"Well, no," said Truffle Hunter, "you don't say so."
"Eh?" said Trumpkin. "What's that? What have you been doing, human, to fall foul of Miraz at your age?"
"He's my uncle," began Caspian,
when Knickerbrick jumped up with his hand on his dagger.
"There you are," he cried, "not only a Telmarine, but close kin and heir to our greatest enemy. Are you still mad enough to let this creature live?"
He would have stabbed Caspian then and there if the badger and Trumpkin had not got in the way and forced him back to his seat and held him down.
"Now, once and for all, Knickerbrick," said Trumpkin, "will you contain yourself, or must Truffle Hunter and I sit on your head?"
Knickerbrick sulkily promised to behave, and the other two asked Caspian to tell his whole story. When he had done so, there was a moment's silence.
"This is the queerest thing I ever heard," said Trumpkin.
"I don't like it," said Knickerbrick. "I didn't know there were stories about us still told among the humans. The less they know about us, the better. That old nurse now, she'd better have held her tongue. And it's all mixed up with that tutor, a renegade dwarf. I hate him. I hate him worse than the humans. You mark my words, no good will come of it."
"Don't you go talking about things you don't understand, Knickerbrick," said Truffle Hunter. "You dwarfs are as forgetful and changeable as the humans themselves. I am a beast, I am, and a badger what's more. We don't change, we hold on. I say great good will come of it. This is the true king of Narnia, and we beasts remember, even if dwarfs forget, that Narnia was never right except when a son of Adam was king."
"Whistles and whirligigs, Truffle Hunter," said Trumpkin. "You don't mean you want to give the country to the humans?"
"I said nothing about that," answered the badger. "It's not man's country. Who should know that better than me? But it's a country for a man to be king of. We badgers have long enough memories to know that. Why, bless us all, wasn't the High King Peter a man?"
"Do you believe all those old stories?" asked Trumpkin.
"I tell you, we don't change, we beasts," said Truffle Hunter. "We don't forget. I believe in the High King Peter and the rest that reigned at Caer Paravel as firmly as I believe in Aslan himself."
"As firmly as that, I dare say," said Trumpkin. "But who believes in Aslan nowadays?"
"I do," said Caspian. "And if I hadn't believed in him before, I would now. Back there among the humans, the people who laughed at Aslan would have laughed at stories about talking beasts and dwarfs. Sometimes I did wonder if there really was such a person as Aslan. But then sometimes I wondered if there were really people like you. Yet there you are."
"That's right," said Truffle Hunter. "You're right, King Caspian. And as long as you will be true to old Narnia, you shall be my king, whatever they say. Long life to your majesty."
"You make me sick, badger," growled Knickerbrick. "The High King Peter and the rest may have been men, but they were a different sort of men. This is one of the cursed Telmarines. He has hunted beasts for sport, haven't you now?"
he said, rounding suddenly on Caspian. "Well, to tell you the truth, I have," said Caspian. "But they weren't talking beasts."
"It's all the same thing," said Knickerbrick.
"No, no, no," said Truffle Hunter. "You know it isn't. You know very well that the beasts in Narnia nowadays are different and are no more than the poor, dumb, witless creatures you'd find in Calormen or Telmar. The smaller two, they're far more different from us than the half-dwarfs are from you."
There was a great deal more talk, but it all ended with the agreement that Caspian should stay, and even the promise that, as soon as he was able to go out, he should be taken to see what Trumpkin called the Others. For apparently, in these wild parts, all sorts of creatures from the old days of Narnia still lived on in hiding. Chapter 6. The People That Lived in Hiding. Now began the happiest times that Caspian had ever known. On a fine summer morning, when the dew lay on the grass, he set off with the badger and the two dwarfs up through the forest to a high saddle in the mountains and down on to their sunny southern slopes, where one looked across the green wolds of Arkenland.
"We will go first to the three bulgy bears," said Trumpkin.
They came in a glade to an old hollow oak tree covered with moss, and Truffle Hunter tapped with his paw three times on the trunk, and there was no answer. Then he tapped again, and a woolly sort of voice from inside said,
"Go away, it's not time to get up yet."
But when he tapped the third time, there was a noise like a small earthquake from inside, and a sort of door opened, and out came three brown bears, very bulgy indeed, and blinking their little eyes. And when everything had been explained to them, which took a long time because they were so sleepy, they said, just as Truffle Hunter had said, that a son of Adam ought to be king of Narnia, and all kissed Caspian, very wet, snuffly kisses they were, and offered him some honey. Caspian did not really want honey without bread at that time in the morning, but he thought it polite to accept. It took him a long time afterwards to get unsticky. After that they went on till they came among tall beech trees, and Truffle Hunter called out,
"Patter twig, patter twig, patter twig!"
And almost at once, bounding down from branch to branch till he was just above their heads, came the most magnificent red squirrel that Caspian had ever seen. He was far bigger than the ordinary dumb squirrels which he had sometimes seen in the castle gardens. Indeed, he was nearly the size of a terrier, and the moment you looked in his face, you saw that he could talk. Indeed, the difficulty was to get him to stop talking, for like all squirrels, he was a chatterer. He welcomed Caspian at once, and asked if he would like a nut, and Caspian said thanks, he would. But as Patter-Twig went bounding away to fetch it, Truffle Hunter whispered in Caspian's ear,
"Don't look, look the other way. It's very bad manners among squirrels to watch anyone going to his store, or to look as if you wanted to know where it was."
Then Patter-Twig came back with the nut, and Caspian ate it, and after that Patter-Twig asked if he could take any messages to other friends.
"For I can go nearly everywhere without setting foot to ground," he said.
Truffle Hunter and the dwarfs thought this a very good idea, and gave Patter-Twig messages to all sorts of people with queer names, telling them all to come to a feast and council on Dancing Lawn at midnight, three nights ahead.
"And you'd better tell the three bulgies, too," added Trumpkin. "We forgot to mention it to them."
Their next visit was to the seven brothers of Shuddering Wood. Trumpkin led the way back to the saddle and then down eastward on the northern slope of the mountains till they came to a very solemn place among rocks and fir trees. They went very quietly, and presently Caspian could feel the ground shake under his feet, as if someone were hammering down below. Trumpkin went to a flat stone about the size of the top of a water butt and stamped on it with his foot. After a long pause, it was moved away by someone or something underneath, and there was a dark, round hole with a good deal of heat and steam coming out of it, and in the middle of the hole the head of a dwarf very like Trumpkin himself. There was a long talk here, and the dwarf seemed more suspicious than the squirrel or the bulgy bears had been, but in the end the whole party was invited to come down. Caspian found himself descending a dark stairway into the earth, but when he came to the bottom he saw firelight. It was the light of a furnace. The whole place was a smithy, A subterranean stream ran past on one side of it. Two dwarfs were at the bellows, another was holding a piece of red-hot metal on the anvil with a pair of tongs, a fourth was hammering it, and two, wiping their horny little hands on a greasy cloth, were coming forward to meet the visitors. It took some time to satisfy them that Caspian was a friend and not an enemy, but when they did, they all cried, "Long live the king!" And their gifts were noble, mail shirts and helmets and swords for Caspian and Trumpkin and Knickerbrick. The badger could have had the same if he had liked, but he said he was a beast, he was, and if his claws and teeth could not keep his skin whole, it wasn't worth keeping. The workmanship of the arms was far finer than any Caspian had ever seen, and he gladly accepted the dwarf-made sword instead of his own, which looked, in comparison, as feeble as a toy and as clumsy as a stick. The seven brothers, who were all red dwarfs, promised to come to the feast at Dancing Lawn. A little farther on, in a dry, rocky ravine, they reached the cave of five black dwarfs. They looked suspiciously at Caspian, but in the end the eldest of them said,
"If he is against Miraz, we'll have him for king."
And the next oldest said,
"Shall we go farther up for you, up to the crags? There's an ogre or two and a hag that we could introduce you to up there."
"Certainly not," said Caspian.
"I should think not indeed," said Truffle Hunter. "We want none of that sort on our side."
Knickerbrick disagreed with this, but Trumpkin and Badger overruled him. It gave Caspian a shock to realize that the horrible creatures out of the old stories, as well as the nice ones, had some descendants in Narnia still.
"We should not have Aslan for a friend if we brought in that rabble," said Truffle Hunter as they came away from the cave of the black dwarfs.
"Thou, Aslan," said Trumpkin cheerily but contemptuously, "what matters much more is that you wouldn't have me."
"Do you believe in Aslan?" said Caspian to Knickerbrick.
"I'll believe in anyone or anything," said Knickerbrick, "that'll batter these cursed Telmarine barbarians to pieces or drive them out of Narnia. Anyone or anything, Aslan or the White Witch, do you understand?"
"Silence, silence," said Truffle Hunter. "You do not know what you are saying. She was a worse enemy than Miraz and all his race."
"Not a dwarf, she wasn't," said Knickerbrick.
Their next visit was a pleasanter one. As they came lower down, the mountains opened out into a great glen or wooded forge with a swift river running at the bottom. The open places near the river's edge were a mass of foxgloves and wild roses, and the air was buzzing with bees. Here Truffle Hunter called again,
"Glenstorm, Glenstorm!"
And after a pause, Caspian heard the sound of hoofs. It grew louder till the valley trembled, and at last, breaking and trampling the thickets, there came in sight the noblest creatures that Caspian had yet seen, the great centaur Glenstorm and his three sons. His flanks were glossy chestnut, and the beard that covered his broad chest was golden red. He was a prophet and a stargazer, and knew what they had come about.
"Long live the king," he cried. "I and my sons are ready for war. When is the battle to be joined?"
Up till now, neither Caspian nor the others had really been thinking of a war. They had some vague idea, perhaps, of an occasional raid on some human farmstead, or of attacking a party of hunters if it ventured too far into these southern wilds. But in the main, they had thought only of living to themselves in woods and caves and building up an attempt at old Narnia in hiding. As soon as Glenstorm had spoken, everyone felt much more serious.
"Do you mean a real war to drive Miraz out of Narnia?" asked Caspian.
"What else?" said the centaur. "Why else does your majesty go clad in mail and girt with sword?"
"Is it possible, Glenstorm?" said the badger.
"The time is ripe," said Glenstorm. "I watch the skies, badger, for it is mine to watch as it is yours to remember. Tava and Alambil have met in the halls of high heaven, and on earth a son of Adam has once more arisen to rule and name the creatures. The hour has struck. Our council at the Dancing Lawn must be a council of war."
He spoke in such a voice that neither Caspian nor the others hesitated for a moment. It now seemed to them quite possible that they might win a war, and quite certain that they must wage one. As it was now past the middle of the day, they rested with the centaurs and ate such food as the centaurs provided, cakes of oaten meal and apples and herbs and wine and cheese. The next place they were to visit was quite near at hand, but they had to go a long way round in order to avoid a region in which men lived. It was well into the afternoon before they found themselves in level fields, warm between hedgerows. There, Truffle Hunter called at the mouth of a little hole in a green bank, and out popped the last thing Caspian expected, a talking mouse. He was, of course, bigger than a common mouse, well over a foot high when he stood on his hind legs, and with ears nearly as long as, though broader than, a rabbit's. His name was Reepicheep, and he was a gay and martial mouse. He wore a tiny little rapier at his side and twirled his long whiskers as if they were a moustache.
"There are 12 of us, sire," he said with a dashing and graceful bow, "and I place all the resources of my people unreservedly at your Majesty's disposal."
Caspian tried hard and successfully not to laugh, but he couldn't help thinking that Reepicheep and all his people could very easily be put in a washing basket and carried home on one's back. It would take too long to mention all the creatures whom Caspian met that day. Clodsley Shovel the Mole, the 3 hard-biters who were badgers like Truffle Hunter, Camillo the Hare, and Hogglestock the Hedgehog. They rested at last beside a well at the edge of a wide and level circle of grass, bordered with tall elms, which now threw long shadows across it, for the sun was setting, the daisies closing, and the rooks flying home to bed. Here they supped on food they had brought with them, and Trumpkin lit his pipe. Nickerbrick was not a smoker.
"Now," said the badger, "if only we could wake the spirits of these trees and this well, we should have done a good day's work."
"Can't we?" said Caspian.
"No," said Truffle Hunter, "we have no power over them. Since the humans came into the land, felling forests and defiling streams, the dryads and naiads have sunk into a deep sleep. Who knows if ever they will stir again, and that is a great loss to our side. The Telmarines are horribly afraid of the woods, and once the trees moved in anger, our enemies would go mad with fright and be chased out of Narnia as quick as their legs could carry them."
"What imaginations you animals have," said Trumpkin, who didn't believe in such things. "But why stop at trees and waters? Wouldn't it be even nicer if the stones started throwing themselves at old Miraz?"
The badger only grunted at this, and after that there was such a silence that Caspian had nearly dropped off to sleep when he thought he heard a faint musical sound from the depth of the woods at his back. Then he thought it was only a dream and turned over again. But as soon as his ear touched the ground, he felt, or heard, it was hard to tell which, a faint beating or drumming. He raised his head. The beating noise at once became fainter, but the music returned, clearer this time. It was like flutes. He saw that Truffle Hunter was sitting up, staring into the wood. The moon was bright. Caspian had been asleep longer than he thought. Nearer and nearer came the music, a tune wild and yet dreamy, and the noise of many light feet, till at last, out from the wood into the moonlight, came dancing shapes such as Caspian had been thinking of all his life. They were not much taller than dwarfs, but far slighter and more graceful. Their curly heads had little horns, the upper part of their bodies gleamed naked in the pale light, but their legs and feet were those of goats.
"Fawns!" cried Caspian, jumping up, and in a moment they were all round him.
It took next to no time to explain the whole situation to them, and they accepted Caspian at once. Before he knew what he was doing, he found himself joining in the dance. Trumpkin, with heavier and jerkier movements, did likewise, and even Truffle Hunter hopped and lumbered about as best he could. Only Nickerbrick stayed where he was, looking on in silence. The fawns footed it all round Caspian to their reedy pipes.
Their strange faces, which seemed mournful and merry all at once, looked into his. Dozens of fauns, Nentius and Obentinus and Dumnus, Volans, Voltinus, Gerbius, Niminus, Norsus and Oscuns. Pattertwig had sent them all. When Caspian awoke next morning, he could hardly believe that it had not all been a dream. But the grass was covered with little cloven hoof marks. Chapter 7. Old Narnia in Danger. The place where they had met the fauns was, of course, Dancing Lawn itself, and here Caspian and his friends remained till the night of the Great Council. To sleep under the stars, to drink nothing but well water, and to live chiefly on nuts and wild fruit was a strange experience for Caspian after his bed with silken sheets in a tapestried chamber at the castle, with meals laid out on gold and silver dishes in the anteroom, and attendants ready at his call. But he had never enjoyed himself more. Never had sleep been more refreshing, nor food tasted more savoury, and he began already to harden, and his face wore a kinglier look. When the great night came, and his various strange subjects came stealing into the lawn by ones and twos and threes, or by sixes and sevens, the moon then shining almost at her full, his heart swelled as he saw their numbers and heard their greetings. All whom he had met were there. Bulgy bears and red dwarfs and black dwarfs, moles and badgers, hares and hedgehogs, and others whom he had not yet seen. Five satyrs as red as foxes, the whole contingent of talking mice, armed to the teeth and following a shrill trumpet, some owls, the old raven of Ravenscore. Last of all, and this took Caspian's breath away, with the centaurs came a small but genuine giant, Wimbleweather of Dead Man's Hill, carrying on his back a basketful of rather seasick dwarfs, who had accepted his offer of a lift and were now wishing they had walked instead. The bulgy bears were very anxious to have the feast first and leave the council till afterwards, perhaps till tomorrow. Leapycheep and his mice said that councils and feasts could both wait and proposed storming Miraz in his own castle that very night. Pattertwig and the other squirrels said they could talk and eat at the same time, so why not have the council and feast all at once? The moles proposed throwing up entrenchments round the lawn before they did anything else. The fauns thought it would be better to begin with a solemn dance. The old raven, while agreeing with the bears that it would take too long to have a full council before supper, begged to be allowed to give a brief address to the whole company. But Caspian and the centaurs and the dwarfs overruled all these suggestions and insisted on holding a real council of war at once. When all the other creatures had been persuaded to sit down quietly in a great circle, and when, with more difficulty, they had got Pattertwig to stop running to and fro and saying, "Silence, silence, everyone, for the king's speech!" Caspian, feeling a little nervous, got up. "Narnians," he began, but he never got any further, for at that very moment Camillo the hare said, "Hush, there's a man somewhere near." They were all creatures of the wild, accustomed to being hunted, and they all became still as statues. The beasts all turned their noses in the direction which Camillo had indicated. "Smells like a man, and yet not quite like man," whispered Truffle Hunter. "It's getting steadily nearer," said Camillo. "Two badgers, and you three dwarfs, with your bows at the ready, go softly off to meet it," said Caspian.
"We'll settlin'," said a black dwarf grimly, fitting a shaft to his bowstring.
"Don't shoot if it is alone," said Caspian. "Catch it."
"Why?" asked the dwarf.
"Do as you're told," said Glenstorm the centaur.
Everyone waited in silence while the three dwarfs and two badgers trotted stealthily across to the trees on the northwest side of the lawn. Then came a sharp dwarfish cry.
"Stop! Who goes there?"
And a sudden spring. A moment later, a voice which Caspian knew well could be heard saying,
all right, I'm unarmed. Take my wrists if you like, worthy badgers, but don't bite right through them. I want to speak to the king."
"Dr. Cornelius!" cried Caspian with joy, and rushed forward to greet his old tutor. Everyone else crowded round.
"Pah!" said Nicobrick. "A renegade dwarf for half an half. Shall I pass my sword through its throat?"
"Be quiet, Nicobrick," said Trumpkin. "The creature can't help its ancestry."
"This is my greatest friend and the saviour of my life," said Caspian. "And anyone who doesn't like his company may leave my army at once." "Dearest Doctor, I am glad to see you again. However did you find us out?"
"By a little use of simple magic, Your Majesty," said the Doctor, who was still puffing and blowing from having walked so fast. "But there's no time to go into that now. We must all fly from this place at once. You are already betrayed, and Miraz is on the move. Before midday tomorrow, you will be surrounded."
"Betrayed?" said Caspian. "And by whom?"
"Another renegade dwarf, no doubt," said Nicobrick.
"By your horse, Destria," said Dr. Cornelius. "The poor brute knew no better. When you were knocked off, of course, he went dawdling back to his stable in the castle. Then the secret of your flight was known. I made myself scarce, having no wish to be questioned about it in Miraz's torture chamber. I had a pretty good guess from my crystal as to where I should find you. But all day, that was the day before yesterday, I saw Miraz's tracking parties out in the woods. Yesterday I learned that his army is out. I don't think some of your, pure-blooded dwarfs have as much woodcraft as might be expected. You've left tracks all over the place. Great carelessness. At any rate, something has warned Miraz that old Narnia is not so dead as he had hoped, and he is on the move."
"Hooray!"
said a very shrill and small voice from somewhere at the Doctor's feet.
"Let them come. All I ask is that the King will put me and my people in the front."
"What on earth?" said Dr. Cornelius. "Has Your Majesty got grasshoppers or mosquitoes in your army?"
Then, after stooping down and peering carefully through his spectacles, he broke into a laugh.
"By the lion," he swore, "it's a mouse. Senior Mouse, I desire your better acquaintance. I am honoured by meeting so valiant a beast."
"My friendship you shall have, learned man," piped Reepy Cheep. "And any dwarf or giant in the army who does not give you good language shall have my sword to reckon with." "Is there time for this foolery?"
asked Nicobrick.
"What are our plans, battle or flight?"
"Battle, if need be," said Trumpkin. "But we are hardly ready for it yet, and this is no very defensible place."
"I don't like the idea of running away," said Caspian.
"Hear him! Hear him!" said the bulgy bears. "Whatever we do, don't let's have any running. Especially not before supper, and not too soon after it, neither."
"Those who run first do not always run last," said the centaur. "And why should we let the enemy choose our position instead of choosing it ourselves? Let us find a strong place."
"That's wise, Your Majesty, that's wise," said Truffle Hunter.
"But where are we to go?"
asked several voices.
"Your Majesty," said Dr. Cornelius, "and all you variety of creatures, I think we must fly east and down the river to the great woods. The Telmarines hate that region. They've always been afraid of the sea and of something that may come over the sea. That is why they have let the great woods grow up. If traditions speak true, the ancient Cair Paravel was at the river mouth. All that part is friendly to us and hateful to our enemies. We must go to Aslan's How."
"Aslan's How?" said several voices. "We do not know what it is."
"It lies within the skirts of the great woods, and it is a huge mound which Narnians raised in very ancient times over a very magical place, where there stood, and perhaps still stands, a very magical stone. The mound is all hollowed out within into galleries and caves, and the stone is in the central cave of all. There is room in the mound for all our stores, and those of us who have most need of cover and are most accustomed to underground life can be lodged in the caves. The rest of us can lie in the wood. At a pinch, all of us, except this worthy giant, could retreat into the mound itself, and there we should be beyond the reach of every danger except famine."
"It is a good thing we have a learned man among us," said Truffle Hunter, but Trumpkin muttered under his breath,
soup and celery. I wish our leaders would think less about these old wives' tales and more about victuals and arms.
But all approved of Cornelius's proposal, and that very night, half an hour later, they were on the march. Before sunrise, they arrived at Aslan's How. It was certainly an awesome place, a round green hill on top of another hill, long since grown over with trees, and one little, low doorway leading into it. The tunnels inside were a perfect maze till you got to know them, and they were lined and roofed with smooth stones, and on the stones, peering in the twilight, Caspian saw strange characters and snaky patterns, and pictures in which the form of a lion was repeated again and again. It all seemed to belong to an even older Narnia than the Narnia of which his nurse had told him. It was after they had taken up their quarters in and around the How that fortune began to turn against them. King Miraz's scouts soon found their new lair, and he and his army arrived on the edge of the woods, and as so often happens, the enemy turned out stronger than they had reckoned. Caspian's heart sank as he saw company after company arriving, and though Miraz's men may have been afraid of going into the wood, they were even more afraid of Miraz. And with him in command, they carried battle deeply into it, and sometimes almost to the How itself. Caspian and other captains, of course, made many sorties into the open country. Thus there was fighting on most days, and sometimes by night as well. But Caspian's party had, on the whole, the worst of it.